Now we're still accumulating general understanding of the Old Testament. It's very important that you see this as, what shall I say, fireside or armchair chats about the Old Testament and not as an outlined and exhaustive study of it. If you want an exhaustive study, then that's in the Institute. You have to go to that. Our good buddy Bill Brown is going through the Bible book by book and giving quite a study in it. That's a different proposition, but we're trying, from whatever source possible, to get a broad understanding of the Old Testament and therefore of what God is trying to say to us in the Old Testament. The Old Testament focuses pretty much on the Middle East. And interestingly enough, that's what has been the focus of modern society, and not without reason. When you look at it, the issue, and you say to yourself, when three-fourths of the world is blessed with luxuriant growth and rivers and lakes and mountains and forests and so forth, is bountiful, which is America, for example, is the most bountiful land in the world, I guess. You ask yourself, why all this focus on the Middle East, which is for the most part a rather barren wilderness? There's oil over there, but there's oil over here too, you know. There's a lot of oil on the Western Hemisphere, on the Western continent. A lot of oil in Mexico, a lot of oil in Alaska, as well as in Texas. And, of course, we would like to be assured of a greater supply of oil, but that's all basically that there is over there. So what is this thing all about? Why should the United States, for example, be, for the most part, luxuriant land? So, but a lot of the plain states are kind of not barren, but no, they're just, of course, wheat. That we grow the wheat over there, but the whole land of America, I'm really kidding you, the whole land of America is just bountiful, and if stuff hasn't been grown, it can be grown. You know, the only reason the plain states remain so long just barren is because the Indians ran buffalo there, and they didn't think much about growing corn or anything else. So, but the whole of America is that. But here's the Middle East, barren, arid, and Israel itself, Palestine itself, great sections of it, barren, arid, lunar landscape. Down there in the Negev, it's lunar landscape, hot and dry and rocky, and the Dead Sea is full of salt. Why? And, of course, I should remind you once again that the whole Old Testament focuses on that Middle East. This is the great object lesson of God. His symbol, the essential revelation of what God has in mind in the world. Now, that region in the beginning, of course, was the Garden of Eden. Certainly, the Garden of Eden covered the Fertile Crescent from the Mediterranean Sea to the Persian Gulf. Certainly that. More than that, it probably also covered the Arabian Desert. It is quite likely that the Arabian Desert became that way after the curse, where by the sweat of the brow one would eat one's bread. So probably all of that area was touched by this Edenic curse. Now that revealed the cost, the price of disobedience, of ignoring God. Now that whole area is the gigantic stage on which God is enacting the scenario of redemption. That was first the glorious, magnificent creation And then there was the cursing of the land. There was the selection of a people. And rather miraculous care of that people as God took Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees, saw him safely across that land to Palestine, what is now Palestine, saw him abundantly blessed there. Abraham became quite a, he was like an Oriental potentate with his great flocks and herds. And when his brother or his nephew Lot got into trouble, he raised an army of 300 men from his own ranks, just from his own household. And they went out and rescued Lot from the kings of that region that had come and taken his nephew away. And anyway, Abraham was greatly blessed, very wealthy. Then, of course, was given the seed, Isaac. And God promised to Abraham that whole land. I could read the passages there, but you find it in Genesis 12 and following. God said, I'm going to prosper your seed and give them all of this land. Now, of course, you are all well familiar with the story of the trek into Egypt and the enslavement there, 400 years of bitter slavery. Well, I say bitter. They ate apparently fairly well, because when they're out in the wilderness, they longed for the refined foods of Egypt, the leeks and the garlics and so forth, the seasonings that they missed. I mean, how long can you eat honey wafers? They stick in the throat after a while. But God saw them across that wilderness and into the promised land, which was, he said, a land flowing with milk and honey, which apparently was. When the spies went into that land from the children of Israel, sent in there by Moses, they came back with the report that it was a land indeed flowing with milk and honey. And they brought a great bunch of grapes, which they had to carry on a pole between them. Those are pretty good grapes. Even California doesn't grow grapes like that. But they look like, apparently, miniature prunes or something. It was a luxuriant land. Now, once again, the children of Israel got into trouble. Now, see, God miraculously took them across that desert. Hard even for lizards to live down there, that Sinai desert. But God took that whole bunch across there, maybe a half million people. And were fed and clothed. The clothes didn't wear out. The shoes did not wear out on their feet. The Lord seems to do things like that for us today. It's a modest thing, but I should really say to you that the Lord does take care of us too. It's an object lesson for it. That's not the primary thing of the Old Testament, but it is an object lesson. The Lord has in so many ways taken care of us. Down there at the mission, it's a miraculous thing, you know, that we survive year after year after year. We've been going just like this for 20 or 30 years, and it's going steady. And things somehow get done and get taken care of. We seem to eat and to maintain ourselves. But the point is that God has made of the children of Israel this great object lesson. He was able to take care of them in that desert. Money wouldn't have done them any good there, incidentally, because they couldn't pop over to the local fruit stand and buy something to eat, which gives rise to the point that you don't always need money. Somebody says money isn't everything, but it's way ahead of whatever's in second place. But the point is, it isn't always money. There are ways the Lord has of taking care of us apart from money per se. So he took care of them. He didn't make them rich, but he gave them, they were supplied. All right, anyway, that's just a side angle. He took care of them in miraculous ways, provided water for them in the wilderness, provided food, of course, and protected them from the enemy. When they went up against Amalek, for example, one of those Bedouin sheiks, and they went up against the Edomites, different ones, Moabites, and the Lord preserved them. It was remarkable that that little band of people were so well preserved going through enemy territory. Now, moreover, when they got into the promised land, he did bless them there, but they began to play footsie with the pagan deities. God had told them to drive out the enemy. He said, get rid of the corrupting elements. Now, of course, they got soft-hearted about it and didn't do that. They only partially did it, which in itself is an object lesson to us, that many times there are corrupting elements in life that the Lord may speak to us to separate from. Just as a simple matter, sometimes we have to make very difficult decisions about relatives, how much we associate with them or how much we involve them with our children and so forth. And sometimes there are hard decisions to make about that. But if you have relatives that are a corrupting influence on the children, you may have to separate from them. I've always been a firm believer in that special seasons like Christmas and holidays and so forth, if you've got relatives that are non-Christian, that are unsympathetic with you, and you let them spoil your holiday just because of some social amenities, you're seven times a fool, you know. Sometimes there are hard decisions, but we gasp over that and say, oh, how awful to think of separating from our relatives. But maybe it's more awful to think of the corrupting effects of these relatives and of the spoiling of our fellowship with Christ over it. Many, many times, young people, for example, just recently married or having some children, would like, for example, to fellowship on Christmas Day with the group. And they feel bound to go and meet with pagan relatives who don't care a rap about Christ. That's a false loyalty, but we have so many bleeding hearts among us, you see. Well, the consequences are sometimes severe of our chicken-heartedness to make the necessary choices we have to make sometimes. And that's where the Lord required that of the Israelites, that they make some hard choices there, drive the enemy out. But because they didn't do that, the enemy destroyed them. They lost everything because the people became settled into the pagan rituals and deities and destroyed the nation. Just because they didn't obey the Lord, had bleeding hearts among them that said, oh, well, we can't do that, that's inhumane. And the result was they destroyed their whole nation. Well, you see, now that's an object lesson. Whenever the children of Israel obeyed the Lord and did what he told them, they got along all right. They were not grand, but they were great. They're identified with God because they had then the heritage of his greatness. But they wanted to be grand, splendid. They wanted to participate in the splendid rituals and ceremonies and celebrations of the pagan societies. And in the end, it destroyed them. And destroyed their land. As long as they obeyed God, however, he kept the enemy away from them. They were, as I said, surrounded. I've said before, they were surrounded by the enemy. The Assyrians down at the Persian Gulf region, or the Mesopotamian Valley, would continually be in battle with the Egyptians. And back and forth, they fought with Israel as the corridor. And they were preserved. When the enemy was at their doorstep, breathing down their neck. And on one occasion, when the Lord had threatened them. That is to say that if you don't straighten up, you're going to get wrapped. And the Assyrians came on them. But that was when Hezekiah was king. But through Hezekiah, the nation underwent a revival. The Assyrians were at the gate, hundreds of thousands strong in their army. And God stopped them and wiped out their armies because Israel repented. In other words, whenever Israel followed the Lord, followed God, kept in his ways, they were preserved in the midst of their enemies. Whenever they disobeyed God, they got off into pagan practices and so forth, he let Satan come in on them. Like the dikes in Amsterdam, or in Holland. The dikes keep out the water, the ocean water. If it weren't for the dikes, the whole land would be inundated. God served as a dike around the people of Israel. That's what he says in Psalm 125, as the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about thee, O Israel. The Lord was their protection, but they had to follow him. They had to do what he said. And, of course, it's a great object lesson for us. I'm not talking about, details and saying you don't dare make a misstep or you're in trouble. I just mean, in general, it's the same with us, that we are surrounded by the enemy. Satan is breathing down our neck all the time. And if the Lord let him loose on us, we'd be wiped out. We're always in vulnerable position. But it's the fact that in our hearts we want to follow him that gives us our safety. And a lot of things that moves we might make that are logically all right, they're sound moves from the natural point of view, but if they're not what God wants, we can be in trouble. But I've always pressed the idea, see what the Lord wants. I think a lot of things may be good, maybe not nothing bad, but if it's not what the Lord wants, we can be in a great deal of difficulty. In taking trips and things like that. Just something you pray about always. Lord, is this something you want? If you don't feel any check against it, you go ahead. But if you feel a check, you don't. A lot of Christians, amazingly enough, don't stop and pray about those things. They don't wait for the Lord's word on it. And they just do their own thing. Well, and sometimes they get into situations that are bad, you see. Now, I would rather take that view than to say God was not gracious. I'd rather put the onus on that point than to say God failed. But it's a rather logical thing to say that apparently, this is just what I see, apparently the Lord does not intervene in these situations. But he would if a person prayed about it and felt a check about the situation, maybe be protecting them from a mishap that will take place. Those are tricky subjects, but what I'm saying is an object lesson with Israel, that the only safety they had was staying with God, you see, just being faithful to him and doing what he wanted them to do and living for him. Because the moment they started getting nationitis, they were in trouble. Nationalism, per se, has no place in Israel, but it is today the strongest motivation of the country is nationalism. God didn't want nationalism. He wanted Godism, theism. He wanted them to be, he wanted their loyalty to him, not to patriotism as such. Loyalty to God that was important. So anyway, in that respect, you see, the Middle East represents this object lesson of God in terms of how he dealt with Israel as a nation. When they obeyed him and followed him, they were blessed. Well, they finally made the supreme break to idolatry, as a result of which they were all carried into captivity, you see. And they were carried off into Babylon in about 587, 589. And so they were wiped out. Well, they never got back on their feet again. Never got back into the land again until today. Now they're back in the land. But for all the years from 587, let's say just roughly 600 B.C., to almost 2000 A.D., 2600 years, certainly 2,000 full years, 2,500 years, they were kept out of the land, or they were wandering about, and they were badgered and battered and executed and wiped out. Now they're back in the land. Now, you see, God didn't do that because they were all committing petty crimes. You know, it wasn't because there were sinners among them. It wasn't fornication, for example, that caused all the wrath of God to come on them, although he didn't, of course, particularly like that. But the point is that it was their leaving God. It was the supreme adultery of leaving God for pagan idols that brought the death knell to the land. Now, they're back in the land, but not back to God. Now, you see, we took a tour of the synagogues over there. And you had a number of little meeting places, much like our own, a handful of people meeting there, in a city of millions, probably 3 million in Jerusalem. You had more minarets than you had synagogues. The synagogues weren't much bigger than the minarets in circumference. No, they were just little places and a handful of people going there on the Sabbath. But the bulk of the population paid very little attention to God. Even in Menachem Begin's speeches, you see, he has comments now and then that include the name of God. But generally speaking, Israel is not saying to the world, we're in God's hands, see how he is taking care of us. I think some of the more cynical media moguls would be unhappy with that anyway. Just as well they keep their mouth shut about it, because they're not really relying on God. I don't know whether they're back in the land that God's doing or not. They may be back prematurely. I don't know. There might be quite a series of events between now and the ultimate restoration, because in the prophets, almost all the restoration passages include spiritual restoration as well as material restoration, or the land, you see. The kingdom. And I don't see any of that restoration over there. They may have to get another lump on their noggins. And if you leave them in the hands of the Western world, they get a lot of lumps. Everybody was so desperately pleading the cause of the sweet cherubic PLO that they couldn't for anything see Israel. I mean, they were just dumb, just idiots. The world is a bunch of sandbox savants. You know, we're all playing in a sandbox. Just like Americans watching television, they always want the villain to escape, you know. The guy that's robbed the bank, many times Americans sort of root for the robber to get away. we always go for the underdog here in this country. Yes?
All these battles that Israel's winning.
All the battles they're winning. Well, let's look at that phrase. Let us say that they have armed themselves and developed themselves to a high degree, so they are the strongest power in the Middle East, and no one can go up against them. The major battle that they first won, well, there were several, like these, the one that got them into Israel or Palestine in the first place. Then the 67 conflict, which they won. But that, you see, they were beset upon by Nasser. Then, of course, the 73 battle with Syria. And now, of course, the invasion of Lebanon. And yes, all right, they have won a number of battles. You're right there. I wanted to just take a quick survey to see where we were at on this battle business. Now, did they win this by God's hand or by their own might? I have to be very frank to say I don't know. I don't know. They had the might to win it. It's like saying a man who's got $1 million goes into a successful business venture. Now, did would he have been successful anyway? Having $1 million helps. Well, a great deal. You've got the strongest force in the Middle East, the likelihood of your winning is there. Now, in the old days, see, they won battles where they were totally outnumbered. And, of course, I'd say they won their original battle pretty much outnumbered. Maybe God took them into that first. Maybe God did bring them in the first place. I would suspect he did. They were totally in the position they were in the old days, where they were not at all capable, without some help, of winning that battle. Now, I don't know, today in this thing in Beirut, you see the PLO, the chicken PLO, the chicken army, put all their forces down in the residential areas. Now, that is about as chicken as you can get. I don't know whether it's chicken or turkey. They better watch out around Thanksgiving, I'll say that. they're turkeys. I mean, they're terrible. That's a very mild name for them. To put their armaments in the middle of the residential areas. And the dingbats over here in America, the bleeding hearts, couldn't see that. That was all, I mean, the newspaper were filled how terrible that the Israeli were bombing Beirut and so forth. But they warned them. The Israelis warned the citizens of Beirut. This guy that has the restaurant down there that we frequent and support for the most part, largely, corner. These people are Lebanese, and they accept that point. And he said that, to this one fellow. Yes, Israel warned us, warned our people. He still doesn't know if his family's alive or dead. But he was glad the Israelis went in. And he said they warned us ahead of time. But anyway, the PLO put their forces right down the middle of the residential area. Now, the point I'm making about that is this. If God were on their side, if God were giving them the victory there, is it not possible he would have executed or expelled the PLO without hurting the citizens? Because you had more or less innocent bystanders in the citizens of Beirut. They did not want the PLO in there. The PLO was terrorizing them. Incidentally, there's quite an extensive question and answer interview in the Herald Examiner a week ago about the PLO in Lebanon and the things that were happening there. I noticed that the Examiner, for the first and the only time in all the years I've read the Examiner, they put this question and answer section back in the advertising section without any indication that it was back there, whereas always this question and answer begins on the first page or at most the second page. They put it back in part three, the classified ad section, and only the persistence of the reader here got him to that article. So the press, the media, have for the most part been siding with the Arabs in this matter. But the Lebanese themselves feel that they have been delivered now. Some of the recent materials coming out have indicated that. And this fellow indicated it in the interview that they had, that they were really being delivered from the PLO. Now, you're asking, what does this have to do with anything? Well, what it has to do with it is, if God had been involved in this matter, is it not possible that because these Lebanese were innocent citizens, it's not like in the old days with Canaan where the people were themselves participating in the orgiastic religious practices. So if God allowed a nation of people to be wiped out, he was wiping out a corrupt element among humanity, you see. But that was not true. A lot of these Lebanese, of course, were Christians. You have a mix of Christian and Muslim population in Lebanon, which makes a lot of problems. There are a lot of Christians there. And it's quite likely that God would have found a way to preserve the people even as he expelled the PLO. I've given you many different sides of a question which has no good answer because I don't know. But it just seems to me that the way things are happening over there, nobody is giving glory to God for it. In the old days, people marveled there were wondrous things that happened with God wiping out armies for the sake of his people. The things that happened in Egypt, wiping out the Egyptian army as they crossed the Red Sea and so forth. These were marvelous things that God's thumbprint was on. But I don't see God's thumbprint on this activity of Israel. I don't know whether it's nevertheless something he's in, but I just can't. It's not there. I've often said if you have to ask, he isn't there, you know. Like a lot of these meetings that are in the charismatic types, you know, if you have to ask if this is the Lord's doing, it's probably not, you know. It's so questionable. I have a suspicion that the way things are going to go over there, if you're interested in what my suspicions are, I'm a suspicious character, given no single country in the Middle East is able to go up against Israel, given that. B, given the fact the Arab world is extremely disunited. And C, the world in general, and the United States in particular, upon whom Israel really depends a great deal in some respects, given the fact that we are naive about things, and that we will make a soft negotiation, which will leave the Middle East in limbo, limbus infantum. I suspect that what will happen over there is that they'll rock along with an uneasy truce for a great many years. And the Palestinians will get settled somewhat. They'll get some kind of a settlement there. Remember what I've said, that the reason they want a settlement on the West Bank is because they want their toehold there. The moment they abandon the total West Bank and therefore abandon their position altogether with Palestine, they have tacitly admitted that Israel has a right to be there. To this day, they do not admit that Israel has a right to be there. And as long as they lay their claim to the West Bank, you see, they can still say that we are the true Palestinians and that the Israeli are intruders. That's a thorny problem. Like I said this morning, the people who read the Quran, which very few do, will have to understand that no one, no Arab, no Muslim can grant to Israel the right to Palestine without going contrary to the Quran. Guess what the Quran's all about? It was Ishmael that was the heir of Abraham's estate there and not the Israelis, and that therefore the Palestinians are the rightful heirs to the land, the Arabs, the Palestinians. And Israel is an intruder. And so if they don't maintain that stand, they're going contrary to the Quran. That's why I don't care what they say publicly. It is not what they say publicly in English, but what they say privately in Arabic that is what they really believe. Don't ever pay any attention to anything any of them say publicly in English. There's nothing Arafat says you can depend on. There's nothing that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, I mean the now King of Saudi Arabia, what is it, Fahid? I met the Crown Prince over in Washington, D.C. years ago. He wouldn't remember me today, but he was in the home that I was staying in, and I met him over there, but he dated one of the young women in that place. She wasn't too young at that time. Divorcee living there. But I wouldn't believe anything he said, he came out with his great 8-point peace plan at the time of the AWAC deal, and included in that 8-point peace plan was that they would grant to every state in the Middle East sovereign right. And while the Honorable Ronald was kicking up his heels in joy over that concession, he needed to realize that they did not recognize Israel as a state at all. They were not granting anything to Israel. Israel is not a state at all in their eyes. They have no right to statehood, so they we're not including Israel de facto in that statement. Now, friends and loved ones, that is what the Old Testament is all about. The sorting out of issues in the Middle East. The development of the nation of Israel in the Middle East. The interaction with the Goyim, the Gentile nations around Israel. The whole thing is the giant stage on which the scenario is being enacted, the redemption. And there's no use to try to smuggle in the Western world into it. In terms of the stated elements of Scripture. Now, the fact that it's going to spill out into the Western world is obvious. This is the population spilled out of the Mediterranean basin and went in rivers to the corners of the earth. So the effects of the Middle Eastern activity spill over the basin into the Western world. But the basic focal point is the Middle East. I want you to get a broader picture here of the Old Testament than simply the idea that here is Abraham and here is Joseph and here is Moses and here is Joshua, etc., etc., etc. I want you to see the broader picture here. Well, let's pray.